Brom dug through the items, handed Aragorn the pair of gloves, and packed the rest of the supplies into their saddlebags. Aragorn pulled the gloves on, being careful to keep his palm facing down, and flexed his hands. The leather felt good and strong, though it was scarred from use.
"Well," said Brom, "as I promised, we will go now."
Trevor nodded.
"When you enter Drasleona, would you do us this favor? Alert the Empire to our plight and that of the other towns. If word of this hasn't reached the king by now, it's cause for worry. And if it has, but he has chosen to do nothing, that too is cause for worry."
"We will carry your message. May your sword stay sharp," said Brom.
"And yours."
The wagons were pulled out of their way and they rode from Darrett into the trees along the Nenor River. Aragorn sent his thoughts to Saphira.
"We're on our way back. Everything turned out all right."
Her only response was simmering anger. Brom pulled at his beard.
"The Empire is in worse condition than I had imagined. When the traders visited Carver Hall, they brought reports of unrest, but I never believed that it was this widespread. With all these Urgals around, it seems that the Empire itself is under attack, yet no troops or soldiers have been sent out. It's as if the king doesn't care to defend his domain."
"It is strange," agreed Aragorn. Brom ducked under a low-hanging branch.
"Did you use any of your powers while we were in Darrett?"
"There was no reason to."
"Wrong," corrected Brom. "You could have sensed Trevor's intentions. Even with my limited abilities, I was able to do that. If the villagers had been bent on killing us, I wouldn't have just sat there. However, I felt there was a reasonable chance of talking our way out of there, which is what I did."
"How could I know what Trevor was thinking?" asked Aragorn. "Am I supposed to be able to see into people's minds?"
"Come now," chided Brom. "You should know the answer to that. You could have discovered Trevor's purpose in the same way that you communicate with Cadoc or Saphira. The minds of men are not so different from a dragon's or horse's. It's a simple thing to do, but it's a power you must use sparingly and with great caution. A person's mind is his last sanctuary. You must never violate it unless circumstances force you to. The riders had very strict rules regarding this. If they were broken without due cause, the punishment was severe."
"And you can do this, even though you aren't a rider?" asked Aragorn.
"As I said before, with the right instruction, anyone can talk with their minds, but with differing amounts of success. Whether it's magic, though, is hard to tell. Magical abilities will certainly trigger the talent, or becoming linked with a dragon, but I've known plenty who learned it on their own." "Think about it. You can communicate with any sentient being, though the contact may not be very clear. You could spend the entire day listening to a bird's thoughts or understanding how an earthworm feels during a rainstorm. But I have never found birds very interesting. I suggest starting with a cat. They have unusual personalities."
Aragorn twisted Cadoc's reins in his hands, considering the implications of what Brom had said.
"But if I can get into someone's head, doesn't that mean that others can do the same to me? How do I know if someone's prying in my mind? Is there a way to stop that? How do I know if Brom can tell what I'm thinking right now?"
"Why, yes. Hasn't Saphira ever blocked you from her mind?"
"Occasionally," admitted Aragorn. "When she took me into the spine, I couldn't talk to her at all. It wasn't that she was ignoring me. I don't think she could even hear me. There were walls around her mind that I couldn't get through."
Brom worked on his bandage for a moment, shifting it higher on his arm.
"Only a few people can tell if someone is in their mind, and of those, only a handful could stop you from entering. It's a matter of training and of how you think. Because of your magical power, you'll always know if someone is in your mind. Once you do, blocking them is a simple matter of concentrating on one thing to the exclusion of all else. For instance, if you only think about a brick wall, that's all the enemy will find in your mind. However, it takes a huge amount of energy and discipline to block someone for any length of time. If you're distracted by even the slightest thing, your wall will waver and your opponent will slip in through the weakness."
"How can I learn to do this?" asked Aragorn.
"There is only one thing for it. Practice, practice, and yet more practice. Picture something in your mind and hold it there to the exclusion of all else for as long as you can. It's a very advanced ability. Only a handful ever master it," said Brom.
"I don't need perfection, just safety." If I can get into someone's mind, can I change how he thinks? Every time I learn something new about magic, I grow more wary of it.
When they reached Saphira, she startled them by thrusting her head at them. The horses backstepped nervously. Saphira looked Aragorn over carefully and gave a low hiss. Her eyes were flinty. Aragorn threw a concerned look at Brom. He had never seen Saphira this angry. Then asked, "What's wrong?"
"You,"
she growled.
"You are the problem."
Aragorn frowned and got off Cadoc. As soon as his feet touched the ground, Saphira swept his legs out from under him with her tail and pinned him with her talons.
"What are you doing?"
he yelled, struggling to get up, but she was too strong for him. Brom watched attentively from Snowfire. Saphira swung her head over Aragorn until they were eye to eye. He squirmed under her unwavering glare.
"You! Every time you leave my sight, you get into trouble. You're like a new hatchling, sticking your nose into everything. And what happens when you stick it into something that bites back? How will you survive then? I cannot help you when I'm miles away. I've stayed hidden so that no one would see me, but no longer. Not when it may cost you your life."
"I can understand why you're upset," said Aragorn. "But I'm much older than you and can take care of myself. If anything, you're the one who needs to be protected."
She snarled and snapped her teeth by his ear.
"Do you really believe that?"
she asked.
"Tomorrow you will ride me, not that pitiful deer animal you call a horse, or else I will carry you in my claws. Are you a dragon rider or not? Don't you care for me?"
The question burned in Aragorn, and he dropped his gaze. He knew she was right, but he was scared of riding her. Their flights had been the most painful ordeal he had ever endured.
"Well?" demanded Brom.
"She wants me to ride her tomorrow," said Aragorn lamely. Brom considered it with twinkling eyes.
"Well, you have the saddle. I suppose that if the two of you stay out of sight, it won't be a problem."
Saphira switched her gaze to him, then returned it to Aragorn.
"But what if you're attacked or there's an accident? I won't be able to get there in time, and—"
Saphira pressed harder on his chest, stopping his words.
"Exactly my point, little one."
Brom seemed to hide a smile.
"It's worth the risk. You need to learn how to ride her anyway. Think about it this way. With you flying ahead and looking at the ground, you'll be able to spot any traps, ambushes, or other unwelcome surprises."
Aragorn looked back at Saphira and said,
"Okay, I'll do it, but let me up."
"Give me your word."
"Is that really necessary?"
he demanded. She blinked.
"Very well. I give you my word that I will fly with you tomorrow. Satisfied?"
"I am content."
Saphira let him up, and with a push of her legs took off. A small shiver ran through Aragorn as he watched her twist through the air. Grumbling, he returned to Cadoc and followed Brom. It was nearly sundown when they made camp. As usual, Aragorn dueled with Brom before dinner. In the midst of the fight, Aragorn delivered such a powerful blow that he snapped both of their sticks like twigs. The pieces whistled into the darkness in a cloud of splintered fragments. Brom tossed what remained of his stick into the fire and said,
"We're done with these. Throw yours in as well. You have learned well, but we've gone as far as we can with branches. There is nothing more you can gain from them. It is time for you to use the blade."
He removed Zarok from Aragorn's bag and gave it to him.
"We'll cut each other to ribbons," protested Aragorn.
"Not so. Again, you forget magic," said Brom.
He held up his sword and turned it so that firelight glinted off the edge. He put a finger on either side of the blade and focused intensely, deepening the lines on his forehead. For a moment, nothing happened. Then he uttered,
"Geuloth Dunifer,"
and a small red spark jumped between his fingers. As it flickered back and forth, he ran his fingers down the length of the sword. Then he twirled it and did the same thing on the other side. The spark vanished the moment his fingers left the metal. Brom held his hand out, palm up, and slashed it with the sword. Aragorn jumped forward, but was too slow to stop him. He was astonished when Brom raised his unharmed hand with a smile.
What did you do? Asked Aragorn.
Feel the edge, said Brom. Aragorn touched it and felt an invisible surface under his fingers. The barrier was about a quarter inch wide and very slippery.
Now do the same on Zarok, instructed Brom. Your block will be a bit different than mine, but it should accomplish the same thing.
He told Aragorn how to pronounce the words and coached him through the process. It took Aragorn a few tries, but he soon had Zarok's edge protected. Confident, he took his fighting stance. Before they started, Brom admonished, These swords won't cut us, but they can still break bones. I would prefer to avoid that, so don't flail around like you normally do. A blow to the neck could prove fatal.
Aragorn nodded, then struck without warning. Sparks flew off his blade and the clash of metal filled their campsite as Brom parried.
The sword felt slow and heavy to Aragorn after fighting with sticks for so long. Unable to move Zarok fast enough, he received a sharp rap on his knee. They both had large welts when they stopped, Aragorn more so than Brom. He marveled that Zarok had not been scratched or dented by the vigorous pounding it had received.
Through a Dragon's Eye. The next morning, Aragorn woke with stiff limbs and purple bruises. He saw Brom carry the saddle to Saphira and tried to quell his uneasiness. By the time breakfast was ready, Brom had strapped the saddle onto Saphira and hung Aragorn's bags from it. When his bowl was empty, Aragorn silently picked up his bow and went to Saphira. Brom said, Now remember, grip with your knees, guide her with your thoughts and stay as flat as you can on her back. Nothing will go wrong if you don't panic.
Aragorn nodded, sliding his unstrung bow into its leather tube, and Brom boosted him into the saddle. Saphira waited impatiently while Aragorn tightened the bands around his legs.
Are you ready?
She asked. He sucked in the fresh morning air.
No, but let's do it.
She agreed enthusiastically. He braced himself as she crouched.
Her powerful legs surged, and the air whipped past him, snatching his breath away. With three smooth strokes of her wings, she was in the sky, climbing rapidly.
The last time Aragorn had ridden Saphira, every flap of her wings had been strained. Now she flew steadily and effortlessly. He clenched his arms around her neck as she turned on edge, banking. The river shrank to a wispy grey line beneath them. Clouds floated around them. When they leveled off, high above the plains, the trees below were no more than specks. The air was thin, chilly, and perfectly clear.
This is wonderful!
His words were lost as Saphira tilted and rolled completely around. The ground spun in a dizzying circle, and vertigo clutched Aragorn.
Don't do that! He cried. I feel like I'm going to fall off!
You must become accustomed to it. If I'm attacked in the air, that's one of the simplest maneuvers I will do,
she replied. He could think of no rebuttal, so he concentrated on controlling his stomach. Saphira angled into a shallow dive and slowly approached the ground. Although Aragorn's stomach lurched with every wobble, he began to enjoy himself. He relaxed his arms a bit and stretched his neck back, taking in the scenery. Saphira let him enjoy the sights a while, then said,
Let me show you what flying is really like.
How?
He asked.
Relax, and do not be afraid, she said.
Her mind tugged at his, pulling him away from his body. Aragorn fought for a moment, then surrendered control. His vision blurred, and he found himself looking through Saphira's eyes.
Everything was distorted. Colors had weird, exotic tints. Blues were more prominent now, while greens and reds were subdued.
Aragorn tried to turn his head and body, but could not. He felt like a ghost who had slipped out of the ether. Pure joy radiated from Saphira as she climbed into the sky. She loved this freedom to go anywhere. When they were high above the ground, she looked back at Aragorn. He saw himself as she did, hanging onto her with a blank look. He could feel her body strain against the air, using updrafts to rise. All her muscles were like his own. He felt her tail swinging through the air like a giant rudder to correct her course. It surprised him how much she depended on it. Their connection grew stronger until there was no distinction between their identities. They clasped their wings together and dived straight down like a spear thrown from on high.
No terror of falling touched Aragorn, engulfed as he was in Saphira's exhilaration. The air rushed past their face, their tail whipped in the air, and their joined minds reveled in the experience. Even as they plummeted toward the ground, there was no fear of collision. They snapped open their wings at just the right moment, pulling out of the dive with their combined strength. Slanting toward the sky, they shot up and continued back over into a giant loop. As they leveled out, their minds began to diverge, becoming distinct personalities again. For a split second, Aragorn felt both his body and Saphira's. Then his vision blurred and he again sat on her back. He gasped and collapsed on the saddle. It was minutes before his heart stopped hammering and his breathing calmed. Once he had recovered, he exclaimed, "That was incredible! How can you bear to land when you enjoy flying so much?"
"I must eat," she said with some amusement. "But I'm glad that you took pleasure in it."
"Those are spare words for such an experience. I'm sorry I haven't flown with you more. I never thought it could be like that. Do you always see so much blue?"
"It is the way I am. We will fly together more often now?"
"Yes, every chance we get."
"Good,"
she replied in a contented tone. They exchanged many thoughts as she flew, talking as they had not for weeks. Saphira showed Aragorn how she used hills and trees to hide, and how she could conceal herself in the shadow of a cloud. They scouted the trail for Brom, which proved to be more arduous than Aragorn expected. They could not see the path unless Saphira flew very close to it, in which case she risked being detected. Near midday, an annoying buzz filled Aragorn's ears, and he became aware of a strange pressure on his mind. He shook his head, trying to get rid of it, but the tension only grew stronger. Brom's words about how people could break into others' minds flashed through Aragorn's head, and he frantically tried to clear his thoughts. He concentrated on one of Saphira's scales and forced himself to ignore everything else. The pressure faded for a moment, and then returned, greater than ever. A sudden gust rocked Saphira, and Aragorn's concentration slipped. Before he could marshal any defenses, the force broke through. But instead of the invasive presence of another mind, there were only the words.
"What do you think you're doing? Get down here. I found something important."
"Brom?" queried Aragorn.
"Yes," the old man said irritably. "Now get that oversized lizard of yours to land. I'm here."
He sent a picture of his location. Aragorn quickly told Saphira where to go, and she banked toward the river below. Meanwhile, he strung his bow and drew several arrows. "If there's trouble, I'll be ready for it."
"As will I," said Saphira.
When they reached Brom, Aragorn saw him standing in a clearing, waving his arms. Saphira landed, and Aragorn jumped off her and looked for danger. The horses were tied to a tree on the edge of the clearing, but otherwise Brom was alone. Aragorn trotted over and asked, "What's wrong?" Brom scratched his chin and muttered a string of curses.
"Don't ever block me out like that again. It's hard enough for me to reach you without having to fight to make myself heard."
"Sorry," he snorted.
"I was farther down the river when I noticed that the Razak's tracks had ceased. I backtracked until I found where they had disappeared. Look at the ground and tell me what you see."
Aragorn knelt and examined the dirt and found a confusion of impressions that were difficult to decipher. Numerous Razak footprints overlapped each other. Aragorn guessed that the tracks were only a few days old. Superimposed over them were long, thick gouges torn into the ground. They looked familiar, but Aragorn could not say why. He stood, shaking his head. "I don't have any idea what..." Then his eyes fell on Saphira, and he realized what had made the gouges. Every time she took off, her back claws dug into the ground and ripped it in the same manner. "This doesn't make any sense, but the only thing I can think of is that the Razak flew off on dragons, or else they got onto giant birds and disappeared into the heavens. Tell me you have a better explanation."
Brom shrugged. "I've heard reports of the Razak moving from place to place with incredible speed, but this is the first evidence I've had of it. It will be almost impossible to find them if they have flying steeds. They aren't dragons, I know that much. A dragon would never consent to bear a Razak."
"What do we do?"
Saphira can't track them through the sky. Even if she could, we would leave you far behind.
There's no easy solution to this riddle, said Brom. Let's have lunch while we think on it. Perhaps inspiration will strike us while we eat.
Aragorn glumly went to his bags for food. They ate in silence, staring at the empty sky. Once again, Aragorn thought of home, and wondered what Rohan was doing. A vision of the burnt farm appeared before him, and grief threatened to overwhelm him. What will I do if we can't find the Razak? What is my purpose then? I could return to Carvajal. He plucked a twig from the ground and snapped it between two fingers. Or just travel with Brom and continue my training. Aragorn stared out at the plains, hoping to quiet his thoughts. When Brom finished eating, he stood and threw back his hood.
I have considered every trick I know, every word of power within my grasp, and all the skills we have. But I still don't see how we can find the Razak.
Aragorn slumped against Saphira in despair.
Saphira could show herself at some town. That would draw the Razak like flies to honey. But it would be an extremely risky thing to attempt. The Razak would bring soldiers with them, and the king might be interested enough to come himself, which would spell certain death for you and me.
So what now? Asked Aragorn, throwing his hands up. Do you have any ideas, Saphira?
No.
That's up to you, said Brom. This is your crusade.
Aragorn ground his teeth angrily and stalked away from Brom and Saphira. Just as he was about to enter the trees, his foot struck something hard. Lying on the ground was a metal flask with a leather strap just long enough to hang off someone's shoulder. A silver insignia Aragorn recognized as the Razak symbol was wrought into it. Excited, he picked up the flask and unscrewed its cap. A cloying smell filled the air, the same one he had noticed when he found Garrow in the wreckage of their house. He tilted the flask, and a drop of clear, shiny liquid fell on his finger. Instantly, Aragorn's finger burned as if it were on fire. He yelped and scrubbed his hand on the ground. After a moment, the pain subsided to a dull throbbing. A patch of skin had been eaten away. Grimacing, he jogged back to Brom. Look what I found! Brom took the flask and examined it, then poured a bit of the liquid into the cap. Aragorn started to warn him. Watch out, it'll burn...
My skin. I know, said Brom. And I suppose you went ahead and poured it all over your hand, your finger. Well, at least you showed sense enough not to drink it. Only a puddle would have been left of you.
What is it? Asked Aragorn.
Oil from the petals of the Seether plant, which grows on a small island in the frigid northern seas. In its natural state, the oil is used for preserving pearls. It makes them lustrous and strong. But when specific words are spoken over the oil, along with a blood sacrifice, it gains the property to eat any flesh. That alone wouldn't make it special. There are plenty of acids that can dissolve sinew and bone, except for the fact that it leaves everything else untouched. You can dip anything into the oil and pull it out unharmed, unless it was once part of an animal or human. This has made it a weapon of choice for torture and assassination. It can be stored in wood, slathered on the point of a spear, or dripped onto sheets so that the next person to touch them will be burned. There are myriad uses for it, limited only by your ingenuity. Any injury caused by it is always slow to heal. It's rather rare and expensive, especially this converted form. Aragorn remembered the terrible burns that had covered Garrow.
That's what they used on him, he realized with horror. I wonder why the Razak left it behind if it's so valuable.
It must have slipped off when they flew away.
But why didn't they come back for it? I doubt that the king will be pleased that they lost it.
No, he won't, said Brom. But he would be even more displeased if they delayed bringing him news of you. In fact, if the Razak have reached him by now, you can be sure that the king has learned your name. And that means we will have to be much more careful when we go into towns. There will be notices and alerts about you posted throughout the empire.
Aragorn paused to think. This oil, how rare is it exactly?
Like diamonds in a pig trough, said Brom.
He amended himself after a second.
Actually, the normal oil is used by jewelers, but only those who can afford it.
So there are people who trade in it?
Perhaps one, maybe two.
Good, said Aragorn. Now, do the cities along the coast keep shipping records?
Brom's eyes brightened.
Of course they do. If we could get to those records, they would tell us who brought the oil south and where it went from there.
And the record of the Empire's purchase will tell us where the Ra'zac live, concluded Aragorn. I don't know how many people can afford this oil, but it shouldn't be hard to figure out which ones aren't working for the Empire.
Genius, exclaimed Brom, smiling. I wish I had thought of this years ago. It would have saved me many headaches. The coast is dotted with numerous cities and towns where ships can land. I suppose that Tirm would be the place to start, as it controls most of the trade.
Brom paused.
The last I heard, my old friend Jode lives there. We haven't seen each other for many years, but he might be willing to help us. And because he's a merchant, it's possible that he has access to those records.
How do we get to Tirm?
We'll have to go southwest until we reach a high pass in the spine. Once on the other side, we can head up the coast to Tirm, said Brom.
A gentle wind pulled at his hair. Can we reach the pass within a week?
Easily. If we angle away from the Ninor and to our right, we might be able to see the mountains by tomorrow.
Aragorn went to Saphira and mounted her. I'll see you at dinner, then. When they were at a good height, he said, I'm going to ride Cadoc tomorrow. Before you protest, know that I am only doing it because I want to talk with Brom.
You should ride with him every other day. That way you can still receive your instruction, and I will have time to hunt.
You won't be troubled by it?
It is necessary.
When they landed for the day, he was pleased to discover that his legs did not hurt. The saddle had protected him well from Saphira's scales.
Aragorn and Brom had their nightly fight, but it lacked energy, as both were preoccupied with the day's events. By the time they finished, Aragorn's arms burned from Zarok's unaccustomed weight.
A Song for the Road. The next day, while they were riding, Aragorn asked Brom,
What is the sea like?
You must have heard it described before, said Brom.
Yes, but what is it really like?
Brom's eyes grew hazy, as if he looked upon some hidden scene. The sea is emotion incarnate. It loves, hates, and weeps. It defies all attempts to capture it with words and rejects all shackles. No matter what you say about it, there is always that which you can't. Do you remember what I told you about how the elves came over the sea?
Yes.
Though they live far from the coast, they retain a great fascination and passion for the ocean. The sound of crashing waves, the smell of salt air, it affects them deeply and has inspired many of their loveliest songs. There is one that tells of this love, if you want to hear it.
I would,
said Aragorn, interested. Brom cleared his throat and said, I will translate it from the ancient language as best I can. It won't be perfect, but perhaps it will give you an idea of how the original sounds. He pulled Snowfire to a stop and closed his eyes. He was silent for a moment, then chanted softly, O liquid temptress, 'neath the azure sky, your gilded expanse calls me, for I would sail ever on, were it not for the elven maid who calls me. She binds my heart with a lily-white tie, never to be broken save by the sea, ever to be torn twixt the trees and the waves.
The words echoed hauntingly in Aragorn's head.
There is much more to that song, the Dusil Bena Datia. I have only recited one of its verses. It tells the sad tale of two lovers, Akalam and Nuada, who were separated by longing for the sea. The elves find great meaning in the story.
It's beautiful, said Aragorn simply.
The spine was a faint outline on the horizon when they halted that evening. When they arrived at the spine's foothills, they turned and followed the mountains south. Aragorn was glad to be near the mountains again. They placed comforting boundaries on the world. 3 days later, they came to a wide road rutted by wagon wheels. This is the main road between the capital, Urubain, and Tirm, said Brom. It's widely used and a favorite route for merchants. We have to be more cautious. This isn't the busiest time of year, but a few people are bound to be using the road.
Days passed quickly as they continued to trek along the spine, searching for the mountain pass. Aragorn could not complain of boredom. When not learning the elven language, he was either learning how to care for Saphira or practicing magic. Aragorn also learned how to kill game with magic, which saved them time hunting. He would hold a small rock on his hand and shoot it at his prey. It was impossible to miss. The results of his efforts roasted over the fire each night. And after dinner, Brom and Aragorn would spar with swords and occasionally fists. The long days and strenuous work stripped Aragorn's body of excess fat. His arms became corded, and his tanned skin rippled with lean muscles. "Everything about me is turning hard," he thought dryly. When they finally reached the pass, Aragorn saw that a river rushed out of it and cut across the road. "This is the Torque," explained Brom. "We'll follow it all the way to the sea." "How can we?" laughed Aragorn. "If it flows out of the spine in this direction, it won't end up in the ocean unless it doubles back on itself." Brom twisted the ring on his finger. "Because in the middle of the mountains rests the Wodark Lake. A river flows from each end of it, and both are called the Torque. We see the eastward one now. It runs to the south, and winds through the brush until it joins Leona Lake. The other one goes to the sea." After 2 days in the spine, they came upon a rock ledge from which they could see clearly out of the mountains. Aragorn noticed how the land flattened in the distance, and he groaned at the leagues they still had to traverse. Brom pointed. "Down there and to the north lies Tirm. It is an old city. Some say it's where the elves first landed in Alagasia. Its citadel has never fallen, nor have its warriors ever been defeated." He spurred Snowfire forward and left the ledge. It took them until noon the next day to descend through the foothills and arrive at the other side of the spine, where the forested land quickly leveled out. Without the mountains to hide behind, Saphira flew close to the ground, using every hollow and dip in the land to conceal herself. Beyond the forest, they noticed a change. The countryside was covered with soft turf and heather that their feet sank into. Moss clung to every stone and branch and lined the streams that laced the ground. Pools of mud pocked the road where horses had trampled the dirt. Before long, both Brom and Aragorn were splattered with grime. "Why is everything green?" asked Aragorn. "Don't they have winter here?"
"Yes, but the season is mild. Mist and fog roll in from the sea and keep everything alive. Some find it to their liking, but to me it's dreary and depressing."
When evening fell, they set up camp in the driest spot they could find. As they ate, Brom commented,
"You should continue to ride Kadok until we reach Tirm. It's likely that we'll meet other travelers now that we're out of the spine, and it will be better if you are with me. An old man traveling alone will raise suspicion. With you at my side, no one will ask questions. Besides, I don't want to show up at the city and have someone who saw me on the trail wondering where you suddenly came from."
"Will we use our own names?" asked Aragorn. Brom thought about it.
"We won't be able to deceive Jode. He already knows my name, and I think I trust him with yours. But to everyone else, I will be Neil, and you will be my nephew, Evan. If our tongues slip and give us away, it probably won't make a difference, but I don't want our names in anyone's heads. People have an annoying habit of remembering things they shouldn't."
A Taste of Tirm. After 2 days of traveling north toward the ocean, Saphira sighted Tirm. A heavy fog clung to the ground, obscuring Brom's and Aragorn's sight, until a breeze from the west blew the mist away. Aragorn gaped as Tirm was suddenly revealed before them, nestled by the edge of the shimmering sea, where proud ships were docked with furled sails. The surf's dull thunder could be heard in the distance. The city was contained behind a white wall, 100 feet tall and 30 feet thick, with rows of rectangular arrow slits lining it, and a walkway on top for soldiers and watchmen. The wall's smooth surface was broken by 2 iron portcullises, one facing the western sea, the other opening south to the road. Above the wall, and set against its northeast section, rose a huge citadel built of giant stones and turrets. In the highest tower, a lighthouse lantern gleamed brilliantly. The castle was the only thing visible over the fortifications. Soldiers guarded the southern gate but held their pikes carelessly.
"This is our first test," said Brom.
Let's hope they haven't received reports of us from the Empire and won't detain us. Whatever happens, don't panic or act suspiciously.
Aragorn told Saphira, You should land somewhere now and hide. We're going in.
Sticking your nose where it doesn't belong, again,
she said sourly.
I know, but Brom and I do have some advantages most people don't. We'll be all right.
If anything happens, I'm going to pin you to my back and never let you off.
I love you too.
Then I will bind you all the tighter.
Aragorn and Brom rode toward the gate, trying to appear casual. A yellow pennant bearing the outline of a roaring lion and an arm holding a lily blossom waved over the entrance. As they neared the wall, Aragorn asked in amazement, How big is this place?
Larger than any city you have ever seen, said Brom.
At the entrance to Tirm, the guards stood straighter and blocked the gates with their pikes.
What's your name? Asked one of them in a bored tone.
I'm called Neil, said Brom in a wheezy voice, slouching to one side, an expression of happy idiocy on his face.
And who's the other one? Asked the guard.
Well, I was getting to that. This would be my nephew, Evren. He's my sister's boy, not a...
The guard nodded impatiently. Yeah, yeah. And your business here?
He's visiting an old friend, supplied Aragorn, dropping his voice into a thick accent. I'm along to make sure he don't get lost, if you get my meaning. He ain't as young as he used to be. Had a bit too much sun when he was younger. Touch of the brain fever, you know.
Brom bobbed his head pleasantly.
Right, go on through, said the guard, waving his hand and dropping the pike. Just make sure he doesn't cause any trouble.
Oh, he won't, promised Aragorn. He urged Cadoc forward, and they rode into Tirm. The cobblestone street clacked under the horses' hooves. Once they were away from the guards, Brom sat up and growled,
Touch of brain fever, eh?
I couldn't let you have all the fun, teased Aragorn.
Brom harrumphed and looked away. The houses were grim and foreboding. Small, deep windows let in only sparse rays of light. Narrow doors were recessed into the buildings. The tops of the roofs were flat, except for metal railings, and all were covered with slate shingles. Aragorn noticed that the houses closest to Tirm's outer wall were no more than one story, but the buildings got progressively higher as they went in. Those next to the citadel were tallest of all, though insignificant compared to the fortress.
This place looks ready for war, said Aragorn.
Brom nodded. Tirm has a history of being attacked by pirates, Urgals, and other enemies. It has long been a center of commerce. There will always be conflict where riches gather in such abundance. The people here have been forced to take extraordinary measures to keep themselves from being overrun. It also helps that Galbatorix gives them soldiers to defend their city.
Why are some houses higher than others?
Look at the citadel, said Brom, pointing. It has an unobstructed view of Tirm. If the outer wall were breached, archers would be posted on all the roofs. Because the houses in the front by the outer wall are lower, the men further back could shoot over them without fear of hitting their comrades. Also, if the enemy were to capture those houses and put their own archers on them, it would be an easy matter to shoot them down.
I've never seen a city planned like this, said Aragorn in wonder.
Yes, but it was only done after Tirm was nearly burned down by a pirate raid, commented Brom.
As they continued up the street, people gave them searching looks, but there was not an undue amount of interest.
Compared to our reception at Darrett, we've been welcomed with open arms. Perhaps Tirm has escaped notice by the Urgals, thought Aragorn.
He changed his opinion when a large man shouldered past them, a sword hanging from his waist. There were other, subtler signs of adverse times. No children played in the streets, people bore hard expressions, and many houses were deserted, with weeds growing from cracks in their stone-covered yards.
It looks like they've had trouble, said Aragorn.
The same as everywhere else, said Brom grimly. We have to find Jode.
They led their horses across the street to a tavern and tied them to the hitching post.
The green chestnut. Wonderful, muttered Brom, looking at the battered sign above them as he and Aragorn entered the building.
The dingy room felt unsafe. A fire smoldered in the fireplace, yet no one bothered to throw more wood on it. A few lonely people in the corners nursed their drinks with sullen expressions. A man missing two fingers sat at a far table, eyeing his twitching stumps. The bartender had a cynical twist to his lips and held a glass in his hand that he kept polishing even though it was broken. Brom leaned against the bar and asked,
"Do you know where we can find a man called Jode?"
Aragorn stood at his side, fiddling with the tip of his bow by his waist. It was slung across his back, but right then he wished that it were in his hands. The bartender said in an overly loud voice,
"Now why would I know something like that? Do you think I keep track of the mangy louts in this forsaken place?"
Aragorn winced as all eyes turned toward them. Brom kept talking smoothly.
"Could you be enticed to remember?"
He slid some coins onto the bar. The man brightened and put his glass down.
"Could be," he replied, lowering his voice. "But my memory takes a great deal of prodding."
Brom's face soured, but he slid more coins onto the bar. The bartender sucked on one side of his cheek undecidedly.
"All right," he finally said, and reached for the coins.
Before he touched them, the man missing two fingers called out from his table,
"Gareth, what in the blazes do you think you're doing? Anyone on the street could tell them where Jode lives. What are you charging them for?"
Brom swept the coins back into his purse. Gareth shot a venomous look at the man at the table, then turned his back on them and picked up the glass again. Brom went to the stranger and said,
"Thanks. The name's Neil. This is Evan."
The man raised his mug to them.
"Martin. And of course you met Gareth."
His voice was deep and rough. Martin gestured at some empty chairs.
"Go ahead and sit down. I don't mind."
Aragorn took a chair and arranged it so his back was to the wall and he faced the door. Martin raised an eyebrow, but made no comment.
"You just saved me a few crowns," said Brom.
"My pleasure. Can't blame Gareth, though. Business hasn't been doing so well lately."
Martin scratched his chin.
"Jode lives on the west side of town, right next to Angela, the herbalist. Do you have business with him?"
"Of a sort," said Brom.
"Well, he won't be interested in buying anything. He just lost another ship a few days ago."
Brom latched onto the news with interest.
"What happened? It wasn't Urgles, was it?"
"No," said Martin. "They've left the area. No one's seen them in almost a year. It seems they've all gone south and east. But they aren't the problem. See, most of our business is through sea trade, as I'm sure you know."
"Well..."
He stopped a drink from his mug.
"Starting several months ago, someone's been attacking our ships. It's not the usual piracy, because only ships that carry the goods of certain merchants are attacked. Jode's one of them. It's gotten so bad that no captain will accept those merchants' goods, which makes life difficult around here, especially because some of them run the largest shipping businesses in the Empire. They're being forced to send goods by land. It's driven costs painfully high, and their caravans don't always make it."
"Do you have any idea who's responsible? There must be witnesses," said Brom.
Martin shook his head.
"No one survives the attacks. Ships go out, then disappear. They're never seen again."
He leaned toward them and said in a confidential tone,
"The sailors are saying that it's magic."
He nodded and winked an eye, then leaned back. Brom seemed worried by his words.
"What do you think?"
Martin shrugged carelessly.
"I don't know. And I don't think I will unless I'm unfortunate enough to be on one of those captured ships."
"Are you a sailor?" asked Aragorn.
"No," snorted Martin. "Do I look like one? The captains hire me to defend their ships against pirates, and those thieving scum haven't been very active lately. Still, it's a good job."
"But a dangerous one," said Brom.
Martin shrugged again and downed the last of his beer. Brom and Aragorn took their leave and headed to the west side of the city, a nicer section of Tirm. The houses were clean, ornate and large. The people in the streets wore expensive finery and walked with authority. Aragorn felt conspicuous and out of place. An Old Friend. The herbalist's shop had a cheery sign and was easy to find. A short, curly-haired woman sat by the door. She was holding a frog in one hand and writing with the other. Aragorn assumed that she was Angela, the herbalist. On either side of the store was a house. "Which one do you think is his?" he asked. Brom deliberated, then said, "Let's find out." He approached the woman and asked politely,
"Could you tell us which house Jord lives in?"
"I could," she continued writing.
"Will you tell us?"
"Yes." She fell silent, but her pen scribbled faster than ever. The frog in her hand croaked and looked at them with baleful eyes. Brom and Aragorn waited uncomfortably, but she said no more. Aragorn was about to blurt something out when Angela looked up.
"Of course, I'll tell you. All you have to do is ask. Your first question was whether or not I could tell you, and the second was if I would tell you. But you never actually put the question to me."
"Then let me ask properly," said Brom with a smile. "Which house is Jord's, and why are you holding a frog?"
"Now we're getting somewhere," she bantered. "Jord is on the right, and as for the frog, he's actually a toad. I'm trying to prove that toads don't exist, that there are only frogs."
"How can toads not exist if you have one in your hand right now?" interrupted Aragorn.
"Besides, what good will it do proving that there are only frogs?"
The woman shook her head vigorously, dark curls bouncing.
"No, no, you don't understand. If I prove toads don't exist, then this is a frog and never was a toad. Therefore, the toad you see now doesn't exist. And," she raised a small finger, "if I can prove there are only frogs, then toads won't be able to do anything bad, like make teeth fall out, cause warts and poison or kill people. Also, witches won't be able to use any of their evil spells, because of course there won't be any toads around."
"I see," said Brom delicately.
"It sounds interesting, and I would like to hear more, but we have to meet Jord."
"Of course," she said, waving her hand and returning to her writing.
Once they were out of the herbalist's hearing, Aragorn said,
"She's crazy."
"It's possible," said Brom, "but you never know. She might discover something useful, so don't criticize. Who knows, toads might really be frogs."
"And my shoes are made of gold," retorted Aragorn. They stopped before a door with a wrought iron knocker and marble doorstep. Brom banged 3 times. No one answered. Aragorn felt slightly foolish.
"Maybe this is the wrong house. Let's try the other one," he said.
Brom ignored him and knocked again, pounding loudly. Again, no one answered. Aragorn turned away in exasperation, then heard someone run to the door. A young woman with a pale complexion and light blonde hair cracked it open. Her eyes were puffy. It looked like she'd been crying, but her voice was perfectly steady.
"Yes, what do you want?"
"Does Jord live here?" asked Brom kindly.
The woman dipped her head a little.
"Yes, he is my husband. Is he expecting you?"
She opened the door no further.
"No, but we need to talk with him," said Brom.
"He is very busy."
"We have travelled far. It's very important that we see him."
Her face hardened.
"He is busy."
Brom bristled, but his voice stayed pleasant.
"Since he is unavailable, would you please give him a message?"
Her mouth twitched, but she consented.
"Tell him that a friend from Gilead is waiting outside."
The woman seemed suspicious, but said,
"Very well."
She closed the door abruptly. Aragorn heard her footsteps recede.
"That wasn't very polite," he commented.
"Keep your opinions to yourself," snapped Brom. "And don't say anything. Let me do the talking."
He crossed his arms and tapped his fingers. Aragorn clamped his mouth shut and looked away. The door suddenly flew open, and a tall man burst out of the house. His expensive clothes were rumpled, his grey hair wispy, and he had a mournful face with short eyebrows. A long scar stretched across his scalp to his temple. At the sight of them, his eyes grew wide, and he sagged against the doorframe, speechless. His mouth opened and closed several times like a gasping fish. He asked softly, in an incredulous voice,
"Brom?"
Brom put a finger to his lips and reached forward, clasping the man's arm.
"It's good to see you, Jord. I'm glad that memory has not failed you, but don't use that name.
It would be unfortunate if anyone knew I was here. Jode looked around wildly, shock plain on his face.
I thought you were dead, he whispered. What happened? Why haven't you contacted me before?
All things will be explained. Do you have a place where we can talk safely? Jode hesitated, swinging his gaze between Aragorn and Brom, face unreadable. Finally he said,
We can't talk here, but if you wait a moment, I'll take you somewhere we can.
Fine, said Brom. Jode nodded and vanished behind the door.
I hope I can learn something of Brom's past, thought Aragorn.
There was a rapier at Jode's side when he reappeared. An embroidered jacket hung loosely on his shoulders, matched by a plumed hat. Brom cast a critical eye at the finery, and Jode shrugged self-consciously. He took them through Tirm, toward the citadel. Aragorn led the horses behind the two men. Jode gestured at their destination.
Ristart, the lord of Tirm, has decreed that all the business owners must have their headquarters in his castle. Even though most of us conduct our business elsewhere, we still have to rent rooms there. It's nonsense, but we abide by it anyway to keep him calm. We'll be free of eavesdroppers in there. The walls are thick.
They went through the fortress's main gate and into the keep. Jode strode to a side door and pointed to an iron ring.
You can tie the horses there. No one will bother them.
When Snowfire and Cadoc were safely tethered, he opened the door with an iron key and let them inside. Within was a long, empty hallway lit by torches set into the walls. Aragorn was surprised by how cold and damp it was. When he touched the wall, his fingers slid over a layer of slime. He shivered. Jode snatched a torch from its bracket and led them down the hall. They stopped before a heavy wooden door. He unlocked it and ushered them into a room dominated by a bearskin rug laden with stuffed chairs. Bookshelves stacked with leather-bound tomes covered the walls. Jode piled wood in the fireplace, then thrust the torch under it. The fire quickly roared.
You, old man, have some explaining to do.
Brom's face crinkled with a smile.
Who are you calling an old man? The last time I saw you, there was no grey in your hair. Now it looks like it's in the final stages of decomposition.
And you look the same as you did nearly 20 years ago. Time seems to have preserved you as a crotchety old man just to inflict wisdom upon each new generation. Enough of this. Get on with the story. That's always what you were good at, said Jode impatiently.
Aragorn's ears pricked up, and he waited eagerly to hear what Brom would say. Brom relaxed into a chair and pulled out his pipe. He slowly blew a smoke ring that turned green, darted into the fireplace, then flew up the chimney.
Do you remember what we were doing in Gilead?
Yes, of course, said Jode. That sort of thing is hard to forget.
An understatement, but true, nevertheless, said Brom dryly. When we were separated, I couldn't find you. In the midst of the turmoil, I stumbled into a small room. There wasn't anything extraordinary in it, just crates and boxes, but out of curiosity I rummaged around anyway. Fortune smiled on me that hour, for I found what we had been searching for.
An expression of shock ran over Jode's face.
Once it was in my hands, I couldn't wait for you. At any second I might have been discovered and all lost. Disguising myself as best I could, I fled the city and ran to the—
Brom hesitated and glanced at Aragorn, then said,
Ran to our friends. They stored it in a vault for safekeeping and made me promise to care for whomever received it. Until the day when my skills would be needed, I had to disappear. No one could know that I was alive, not even you, though it grieved me to pain you unnecessarily. So I went north and hid in Carvajal.
Aragorn clenched his jaw, infuriated that Brom was deliberately keeping him in the dark. Jode frowned and asked,
Then our friends knew that you were alive all along?
Yes,
he sighed.
I suppose the ruse was unavoidable, though I wish they had told me. Isn't Carvajal farther north, on the other side of the spine?
Brom inclined his head. For the first time, Jode inspected Aragorn. His grey eyes took in every detail. He raised his eyebrows and said,
I assume, then, that you are fulfilling your duty.
Brom shook his head.
No, it's not that simple. It was stolen a while ago. At least, that's what I presume, for I haven't received word from our friends, and I suspect their messengers were waylaid. So I decided to find out what I could.
Aragorn happened to be travelling in the same direction. We have stayed together for a time now.
Jode looked puzzled.
But if they hadn't sent any messages, how could you know that it was...
Brom overrode him quickly, saying, Aragorn's uncle was brutally killed by the Razak. They burned his home and nearly caught him in the process. He deserves revenge. But they have left us without a trail to follow, and we need help finding them.
Jode's face cleared. I see. But why have you come here? I don't know where the Razak might be hiding, and anyone who does won't tell you.
Standing, Brom reached into his robe and pulled out the Razak's flask. He tossed it to Jode. There's Seether oil in there, the dangerous kind. The Razak were carrying it. They lost it by the trail, and we happened to find it. We need to see Tirm's shipping records so we can trace the Empire's purchases of the oil. That should tell us where the Razak's lair is.
Lines appeared on Jode's face as he thought. He pointed at the books on the shelves. Do you see those? They are all records from my business. One business. You have gotten yourself into a project that could take months. There is another, greater problem. The records you seek are held in this castle, but only Brand, Ristart's administrator of trade, sees them on a regular basis. Traders such as myself aren't allowed to handle them. They fear that we will falsify the results, thus cheating the Empire of its precious taxes.
I can deal with that when the time comes, said Brom. But we need a few days of rest before we can think about proceeding.
Jode smiled. It seems that it is my turn to help you. My house is yours, of course. Do you have another name while you are here?
Yes, said Brom. I'm Neil, and the boy is Evan.
Aragorn, said Jode thoughtfully. You have a unique name. Few have ever been named after the first rider. In my life, I've read about only three people who were called such.
Aragorn was startled that Jode knew the origin of his name. Brom looked at Aragorn. Could you go check on the horses and make sure they're all right? I don't think I tied Snowfire to the ring tightly enough.
They're trying to hide something from me. The moment I leave, they're going to talk about it.
Aragorn shoved himself out of the chair and left the room, slamming the door shut. Snowfire had not moved. The knot that held him was fine. Scratching the horse's necks, Aragorn leaned sullenly against the castle wall.
It's not fair, he complained to himself. If only I could hear what they are saying. He jolted upright, electrified. Brom had once taught him some words that would enhance his hearing. Keen ears aren't exactly what I want, but I should be able to make the words work. After all, look what I could do with Brisinger.
He concentrated intensely and reached for his power. Once it was within his grasp, he said,
Ver stenner un atra ecke herna,
and imbued the words with his will.
As the power rushed out of him, he heard a faint whisper in his ears, but nothing more.
Disappointed, he sank back,
then started as Jode said, And I've been doing that for almost 8 years now.
Aragorn looked around. No one was there except for a few guards standing against the far wall of the keep. Grinning, he sat on the courtyard and closed his eyes.
I never expected you to become a merchant, said Brom. After all the time you spent in books, and finding the passageway in that manner. What made you take up trading instead of remaining a scholar?
After Gilead, I didn't have much taste for sitting in musty rooms and reading scrolls. I decided to help Argihad as best I could, but I'm no warrior. My father was a merchant as well, you may remember that. He helped me get started. However, the bulk of my business is nothing more than a front to get goods into Cirda.
But I take it that things have been going badly, said Brom.
Yes, none of the shipments have gotten through lately, and Trunchim is running low on supplies. Somehow the Empire, at least I think it's them, has discovered those of us who have been lending support to Trunchim. But I'm still not convinced that it's the Empire. No one sees any soldiers. I don't understand it. Perhaps Galbatorix hired mercenaries to harass us.
I heard that you lost a ship recently.
The last one I owned, answered Jode bitterly. Every man on it was loyal and brave. I doubt I'll ever see them again. The only option I have left is to send caravans to Cirda or Gilead, which I know won't get there, no matter how many guards I hire, or charter someone else's ship to carry the goods. But no one will take them now.
How many merchants have been helping you? Asked Brom.
Oh, a good number, up and down the seaboard. All of them have been plagued by the same troubles. I know what you are thinking. I pondered it many a night myself. But I cannot bear the thought of a traitor with that much knowledge and power.